Midway point of the month of June, Monday, June 15th, right here on Connecticut Today. We welcomed back two-time gubernatorial candidate Oz Griebel to the show in the 2 o'clock hour. Oz talked about a new survey that he has posted on a key website for an organization that he's active with right now, talking about voting and the future of politics here in Connecticut. Also, we carried a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's daily media update for you as well. One of our favorites here on the show, you know him as a former gubernatorial candidate here in Connecticut, but one of the topics that he has taken up again has always been a pet project of his, elections, how they are run, good voting and all that. Oz Griebel is back with us on the program here today on a Monday. Oz, Paul here again. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Understand, Oz, you're touching on something that you and I have talked about the last couple of times we've had you on the program here on Connecticut Today. You are, of course, the chair of the Connecticut chapter of SAM, the Serve America Movement. You're giving out a questionnaire, Oz, regarding voting in the state, a five-question questionnaire. Talk a little about that.
I appreciate the opportunity, Paul, number one. And for those, for the listeners who are interested and be interested in your responses to Paul and any of your colleagues, our website is www.joinsamct.org. And the survey that Paul referenced is there, and it's on five statements, pretty easy to take, basically asking respondents to strongly indicate whether they strongly agree, strongly disagree, agree or don't know. On the statements, takes about less than 60 seconds, and would welcome, as I said, listeners' views. We're trying to get as many people to respond as possible. We'll get over 300 now and are looking to drive that number northward. And I'll talk a little bit about the November election, how we plan to use the survey. But, Paul, you've been great to have me on in the past. SAM's goal here in Connecticut is to, through these election reforms, is to enhance, stimulate greater competition among candidates by providing voters meaningful choice at the polls. And the reason I say meaningful choice is that having run in 10 and again in 18, and particularly in 18, being told, you know, you guys have got, you and your running mate, Romani Frank, have great ideas. I really like your ticket, but if I vote for you, it's a wasted vote. You're a spoiler, et cetera. If I vote for you, Bob Stefanowski will win. Or if I vote for you, Ned Lamont will win. Therefore, you know, the choice in my view is not genuine. So our focus, along with what's going on in many states around the country over the last decade or so, and has heated up, I think, particularly because of the pandemic, and even more recently because of the protests, the Black Lives Matter protests coming out of the George Floyd, the horrific death of George Floyd, yeah. That the focuses have been on, and these are what the questions are about. Do you believe we should have open public primaries in Connecticut? Do you believe we should have ranked choice voting in Connecticut? Do you believe we should have term limits in Connecticut? And do you believe we should have the vote by mail option? And then in the near term, what that's really referencing is, of course, is it having the legislature expand the absentee ballot option for this November. So those are the hearts mm-hmm. of the questions. And I really appreciate the opportunity just to flag them with you and for your listeners.
You know, Oz, I think this is timely, as you say, with everything we have going on. And I would hazard to say, Oz, just, you know, throwing a coin up against the wall here and seeing where it bounces, I would hazard to say that you would get either in the agree or strongly agree pluralities here on several of these questions. If people were just asked about them, I don't know what the regular pollsters do on these things, Oz, if, right. if you have any indication on that, but I think a lot of these would be easy sells to some people.
A great point, Paul, and while you never want to project anything, I am not a professional pollster, so I clearly acknowledge that. We're not asking people the way a Quinnipiac poll would do, is whether you're a likely voter or whether you're registered as an R or D or unaffiliated. So I want to be very clear that I don't expect to have this seen in the same category. But to date, what you just said is spot on. Of the 300-plus responses we have received right now on the five relevant statements, the strongly agree and the agrees are north of 70-75%. Several of the questions, like vote by mail, option are north of 80%. So, but you take all that with a, you know, with an appropriate grain of salt, which is why we want more responses to give us the so-called statistical validity. However, a poll like this would be a survey like this would be judged. But the important thing, and this is one of the things I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes on with you, Paul, is that we plan to send a questionnaire to all the candidates after the August 11th primaries, send a questionnaire to all of the candidates for the state Senate and House offices and to ask them their responses to the same questions. And then our goal is to publish between, say, let's say we send that survey out, that questionnaire out on August 12th, ask candidates to get back to us by early September, and then we would promote the responses or lack thereof that we would get from the candidates so that voters have a chance to put this in their thinking as they go to the polls in November. We know, to state the obvious, that the presidential race is going to dominate everything from buying of advertising to really top of mind and for all of us as voters. We don't want to take our eye off the state Senate and House races because of their importance in all kinds of things, including our state budget, but also on these reform issues. And we recognize that changes of this type, with the exception that the two parties today could open their primaries to unaffiliated voters. That's one of our statements. I think the last time I was on with you, I mentioned that we had sent a letter into Nancy Wyman when she was still chair of the Democratic State Committee and J.R. Mm-hmm. Romano as chair of the Republican Committee, urging them to open their primaries, which were originally in April, now to August, to all unaffiliated voters. As you know, 41%+ of all the registered voters in the state are registered as unaffiliated.
Yeah.
And all of us as taxpayers pay for the primaries, not just the Republicans or Democrats. So to me, that's it. The others are going to probably require legislative and or constitutional changes, which will mean we're talking, you know, 1, 2, 4, 3, 4 legislative sessions as we go down the road. And so we're looking to lay the groundwork in January of 2021, where ideally candidates who were positive on these in support of these initiatives are going to be willing to introduce the legislation that's going to be needed, debate that legislation, and get the process started. So this isn't just an academic exercise in terms of the survey. We were very, very interested in people's responses, not only on just the degree, strongly agree, disagree, but where people don't know, that's their response, where they strongly disagree. It's very important to us to be able to shape the questionnaire appropriately so that the candidates have all the relevant information they need before they respond.
Oz, hang on. I want to talk to you about one question when we come back. In particular, Oz Griebel is the guest. We'll do traffic and weather together. Then more on elections and all that with Oz Griebel after traffic and weather together on WICC. And we are at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. The guest, Oz Griebel, former two-time gubernatorial candidate, now chairs the Connecticut chapter of SAM, S-A-M, the Serve America Movement. Go to the website, which is joinsamct.org. There's a survey there. Oz wants you to take that. It asks five questions. Oz, number four, should Connecticut adopt term limits for our six constitutional offices, governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, treasurer, and comptroller, and for all state Senate and House seats? You know, Oz, I used to be a voracious anti-term limit person. I used to say that, you know, we have term limits every 2 or 4 years. They're called elections. But, you know, Oz, I got to tell you, this is just me talking here. I'm starting to think maybe I'm not there all the way yet, but I'm starting to think this is the way to go, only because, Oz, of two things. Number one, the way that the veteran lawmakers, the committee chairs in Hartford, Oz, they've been there for so long that just by their committee positions, they can keep good legislation from really being taken up. And number two, Oz, I hate to say this, I love the people in this state, I love this state. Oz, I just think that voters sometimes, if for no other reason than familiarity, Oz, they get lazy. And it's like, oh, I recognize the name, so I'm just going to pull that lever or fill in that circle on either side. And to me, it's very frustrating.
Paul, you couldn't have described my evolution of the last 5 to 6 years any better. And I was equally voracious and defensive and saying, you know, by golly, we as voters are supposed to determine who represents us. And obviously, that's what we the people is all about, and why these reforms we believe are so critical. But on the term limits, I'm with you. Your 2 points I would add, or maybe put the footnote on it. It just underscores the power of incumbency. The name recognition issue you mentioned at the end, and it's not just the name recognition issue. Sometimes it's just the fact that everybody thinks they know what a Republican stands for, or everybody thinks they know what a Democrat stands for, even though they may not recognize the individual's name. But clearly, I recognize Mr. X or Ms. Y's name. Yeah. They've been there. I'll just pull the lever for them. And the other thing that I would comment on, a power of incumbency, is I think people become focused on being reelected. Their primary mission in life, once they get there, is to be reelected. In the case of Connecticut, as you know, the state legislators qualify for state pensions and lifetime health care if they're in office for 10 years. So we've got the incentives aligned wrong, and not to go back in history too and rely on it too much, but the whole concept of George Washington not standing for a third term pushing back against the monarchy. Secondly, not running for a third term, which was something he probably would have been unanimously elected for. The notion of the Cincinnatus model of getting the citizens involved on a regular basis, and then after you spend a certain amount of time, you go back to your business. I think you begin to inject into the process more variety of thought, more variety of experience. When you look at the makeup of our legislature in the last 20 years, we have fewer and fewer people who come from the private sector, from the business world, and have the responsibility to meet payroll and the other things that go on when you're in the private sector. It's not the only perspective that should be involved, but it should be in the queue. And I think all those things are critically important to ensuring that we, the people, that principle on which this country is founded, really is the operating principle and not just the theoretical one.
Oz, hang on. We'll do one more break, come back. I want to talk to you about voting this coming fall in the primaries in November and all of that, and what's going on in other states who are not doing so well in their voting procedures. Oz Griebel is the guest. More with Oz straight ahead, 2:46 on the button. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. The website, joinsamct.org, joinsamct.org. And our guest for a few more minutes is former two-time gubernatorial candidate Oz Griebel. Sam is the Serve America movement. Oz chairs the Connecticut chapter. Oz, I know you're big on voting, and obviously the absentee ballot, the mail-in ballot thing, we've talked about it. I have mixed feelings on it. But Oz, I have to ask you, as somebody who watches this thing, here we are in the year 2020. We have defeated diseases. We've defeated evil in World War II. We sent and landed 12 guys on the moon. We do these incredible things. But yet, Oz, if you look at Georgia this past week, and if you look at what's going on now, even in Pennsylvania, with taking days, Oz, why can't we run elections? What's the problem here? How can we go, Oz? We went to the moon.
I would be here. I'd be on some island somewhere.
We went to the moon 50 years ago, Oz. We went to the moon 50 years ago. How can we not calculate elections?
It's mind-boggling. It's unfortunate. It's a travesty. Whatever words you want to put on it, and the reason, if you look at this as I tend to do, as the glass is half full, I think at long last, for all these reasons, the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter protests, the intensity of this presidential election and people's feelings about it, I think at long last we may bring some collective effort to getting elections into the 21st century. And when you were good enough to have me on recently, and we talked at length about the vote by mail option, our recommendation, because there are serious concerns, and you flagged them, and many people have flagged them, those of us who are supportive of the initiative fully understand them, around voter fraud, abuse of the system, delays in counting, and the like. And these are very, very serious issues. I'm very concerned, like so many people are, that we're on a trajectory where not only will the presidential results not be known By midnight on November 3rd. And really, the last couple of elections, they have dragged. In the case of the 2000 election, dragged over 6 weeks because of the Chad issue in Florida. First of all, I think we've got to tone down our own expectations as voters. I mean, do we have to know? Is it critical that we know at midnight on November 3rd? Yeah. Clearly, you've had elections that go back at least before the war where you didn't know for many days. That was, and if you go far enough back, you had weeks that went by until all the states had counted. So I do think as voters, we have to give the professionals a chance to do their job. Secondly, the issues you're raising, part of Georgia's problem, at least as I understand it, had to do with the equipment or the technology that they bought and not being adequate. So one of the things that we recommend, and I still believe this is absolutely the right way to go, we sent a letter into the governor back in, I think, in March, urging him to appoint a voter, what we called a voter participation commission, that would include representatives of both parties. It would include, obviously, the Secretary of State and members of the private sector. For example, we have a company here in Danbury that produces the systems and the equipment for counting absentee ballots and the vote-by-mail option. We would urge, in fact, there was a report that the National Institute for the Vote, National Institute of Vote at Home in Colorado sent a report in response to an executive order that Governor Malloy issued in February of 2018, and it was left hanging all the way till the end of his term. The Institute came in with a comprehensive report on the issues that have to be addressed. So there's work that's been done out there. And our point on the commission is, if all we do is go into the normal thing of legislative hearings, yeah, to me, you're not getting a comprehensive view, because people come up and testify from their own particular perspectives. When I chaired the Transportation Strategy Board in 2000, while a lot of those recommendations were, in fact, virtually none of them were implemented by then Governor Rowland and Governor Rell, It was a bipartisan effort that included the private sector in terms of how we would go about that whole transportation issue. I think there's so many smart people in this state, Paul, that if you get the right people together with the right leadership, they can come back with a comprehensive plan that addresses these shortfalls. Technology is here. For the presidents voted by absentee ballot. Not you can certainly vote by absentee ballot, but in this day and age, we can go to the moon, as you pointed out. The idea that you have to show up at a polling place, you should be welcomed at a polling place, but the fact that you have to do that is your only way to vote, particularly with the threat of a second wave of the pandemic coming in the fall, I think it undermines democracy. You have five states that have moved over the last decade to a total vote-by-mail option: Colorado, Utah, which is obviously a pretty strong Republican red state, Washington State, Arizona. There's a fifth one that's escaped me right at the moment. Mm-hmm. Oregon, I believe, is the fifth state. They've all done this. They've demonstrated that the incidents of fraud are de minimis, and they're easily attracted. When you get a vote-by-mail ballot, it's got coded and all that. So there's a lot out there, Paul, that people should feel comfortable about. But on the other hand, in Connecticut, we need to go through the land of steady habits. We need to make sure we go through our own analysis. But to me, to your point, it's where we have to head eventually.
Oz, thank you. Great hearing from you. Oz Griebel, two-time gubernatorial candidate. Group, the organization, is the Serve America Movement. Sam, check them out on the web. JoinSamCT.org. Take the survey there. Five quick questions. Take you a few seconds, and Oz will be posting the results to these questions and making them available as we get toward the election season. Oz, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul. Look forward to talking to you again. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Oz. Anytime. Oz Griebel, folks.
Our COVID update, which we usually do. Not here with Josh and Paul, but here with a couple other folks, because we're really going to focus on police accountability and what the George Floyd murder meant in terms of this day of reckoning. But first of all, when it comes to our COVID-related, I think you maybe saw the numbers. I think most relevant is that our positive cases were still down at 2%. And that makes us probably in the best five or six states in the country in terms of positivity rate. And that tells us that we're ready to do our next phase of the reopening on Wednesday. We had three fatalities, three too many, but three is the least we've had since the start of this pandemic. Two fewer hospitalizations. over 7,000 tests performed. You can take a look. We're putting up on our site the COVID task force, national task force, where they said Connecticut is one of six states that is ready to be in the green zone, continue reopening, given where we are on testing, given where we are on positivity, and given where we are on our infection rate. Third lowest state in the country when it comes to the infection rate, meaning the number of people that you infect over the course of a period of time. And finally, Johns Hopkins reported that Connecticut is in the top 10 in terms of testing. And this is no victory lap. This is no mission accomplished. This is a way to say, keep up the good work. We've got a long way to go. We talked about at the end of last week what you see in terms of flare-ups around the rest of the country, around the rest of the world. China just had to close up a number of their schools again. I don't want that happening in Connecticut, so I appreciate all of you wearing your mask as necessary. But it's now been more than a couple of weeks since George Floyd's murder. And we've had a number of protests, rightfully so, peaceful protests, for which I'm very thankful here in the state of Connecticut. But I just wanted to talk a little bit more about a police accountability. Let's not wait. I got the legislature coming in this session, but I don't want to wait another minute. I want to do what we can do right now and then work with my friends in the legislature going forward to build off of the good bill that Stastrom and Winfield, Representative Stastrom, Senator Winfield helped inaugurate last year and build off of that this coming session. But most importantly, police accountability is about trust. And good police work doesn't work without trust. And trust doesn't work unless police has the word community, community policing in it. So the first thing I'm directing our state police force to do is build off of what they've got going with their resident state troopers right now. They're resident state troopers who work every week with the high school, work every week with the ministers, work every week with the community leaders. And that's how they're able to maintain a good, close relationship with the community. Community policing, emphasize the word community. I think you saw some of that over the last couple of weeks with the protests and how our state police and municipal police were working with the community and working with the protesters, do everything we can to say, we share your goals and we share your goal also in terms of a peaceful exercise of your First Amendment rights. And I see a lot of municipalities around the state that already understand the importance of community policing. Always love to reference Neil O'Leary in Waterbury and the Police Athletic League, where more and more of the police know these kids because they help teach them basketball or softball in an earlier age. And 10 years later, if they're doing something knucklehead, they can say, I remember when I tried to teach you baseball and I'm still with you today and we're going to get this right. That's what I mean in terms of a liaison and community. We're directing our state police to make sure they have a community liaison officer in each and every one of their troops. Build off of that. Make sure we have those relationships with the community going forward. Make sure we build up trust and earn your trust every day, because that's what good policing is all about. Policing is also of, by, and for the community. And you've heard me say this before, but say it again. I want a police force. I want a state police force. I want administration. I want judges. I want district attorneys who represent the amazing diversity of our state. And right now, we have a long way to go. I looked at the numbers of our state police here in the state of Connecticut, and 80% right now are white males. 80% of our state police are white males. But that's changing. Commissioner Rovella and his amazing team had a mission going back a year saying we are going to do a better job of recruiting. And they've done a better job of recruiting. And we've got our latest class right now back in, about to be graduated, join our state police force. Not 80% white male, 60% white male. Is that great? No. Is that progress? Yes. The rest are female, 10%, black and Puerto Rican, 10%, 10%. So we're doing a better job. We have to do a better job still. Max is putting up on our site the social media campaign we're doing. I know that for the women, we're going to a lot of the teams right now. because those are women on sports teams in high school and college who have leadership capability and not afraid of what it means to be a great state trooper. That's what we're doing at the state level now, and that's what I want our municipal leaders to do the same, and we're going to work with the legislature to make sure that happens. And when we say of, by, and for the community, this goes without saying, this is not some military-style response. We don't need all those military weapons. You saw what was being offered up by the feds. I know going back to 9/11, there was a great deal of urgency in terms of terrorism and the such. We're going to take a pause on those military-style weapons. We've got what we need right now in the case of a terrorist attack, and I want to do everything I can to convince the communities we're there for you. We're there to protect you, and I can't do it unless we're doing it with you. Ravella and our amazing state police and our municipal police cannot do it without you. As you know, we're also going to be instituting no chokehold policy, clear as day, for state police, taking that down to municipal police, working with our legislators on that. Body cams, we've got the money in the budget. I think 95% of our state police have the body cams, dash cams now. We're going to complete that. We have funding available for our municipal police as well. I got to give you confidence. And our state police want you to know they have nothing to hide. They feel proud of the work they're doing and want you to see it. Again, working with Representative Stastrom and Senator Winfield last year and the bill that was passed on a virtually unanimous basis in the Senate, not in the House, 4-day release on those videos, nothing to hide. We want you to have confidence that we're trying to do the very best we can for each and every one of you. And finally, a lot of these were represented in a program called Eight Can't Wait. And we've used that as direction, and we're putting a check next to each of those boxes to give you confidence. We understand what that means. And finally, two things. One, we're going to put in place a use of force portal. We've been working on this for a year, but now is the time to release it. I want you to know town by town, based on gender, based upon race, what our police are doing, how that impacts your community, and how that's broken down by race and gender. I just think in the name of transparency, we want you to see what we're doing, why we're doing it, and what those trend lines are. I think you will see that Connecticut is much less likely to use force than just about any of the other police forces around the country. And for that, I'm proud. And, finally, what I saw in that George Floyd video, and I think a lot of others saw as well, is nobody intervened. Nobody else stepped in. Where were the other police when we needed them to do more? And they didn't. So we are making that a requirement. I know in the George Floyd case, they are being held accountable now, and we're putting that right into our regs for each and every state police so they know you are accountable, not just for your own self, but for those around you. If you see something like that, stop it and report it. Stop it and report it. That is your legal requirement, and we're firm on that. You know, with that, I've got to introduce two friends of mine from the legislature who have taken a real lead on these issues, and I look to for counsel and will be helping to take the lead in the legislature during the next session. One is Joe Varengia. Joe was a cop for, I think, a quarter of a century in West Hartford, also worked in the school system, and now is a chairman of public safety. And after that, I get an opportunity to introduce to you Brandon McGee. Joe?
Thank you. This announcement is significant. I think the governor has identified some key areas where we need to respond sooner than later. This is the first step of many. I look forward to working with the governor and my fellow legislators in working on police reforms. I think it's important, though, to take a moment to recognize the fact that Connecticut has been a leader when it comes to police reforms, particularly when it comes to training. Over the last 3 or 4 years here in the state of Connecticut, we've implemented major changes as a result of working with our stakeholders, our police, our state's attorney, our chiefs of police, our residents from all over the state, in working together to come up with good policies, particularly when it comes to the use of force, de-escalation, and others. But what this incident makes us realize is the fact that we can do more. So I look forward to working with everyone and affecting change. And the governor mentioned the militarization of equipment, and there's been a lot of discussion of that. But I think equally important is that when we talk about changes that we've done over the last 2 or 3 years, we also have changed the way we train our police officers, particularly from a military style type of training to a more collegiate type of training. And that speaks to how we train our officers and how they treat people. And I honestly believe that there's a correlation between the reforms that we've implemented over the last 3 and 4 years and the type of protesting we're seeing here in Connecticut, particularly when we don't see the violence and the destruction of property. Not only do I believe it's a result of training, but also the good work of our community leaders, our police chiefs, in establishing relationships so that when we do have incidents such as this, that the community has been working together. And let me make very clear that there's no room at all, not only in this country, let alone policing, for the type of behavior that we've seen in this incident. So I look forward to working on police reforms so that that doesn't happen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. And Joe's co-chairman is Senator Dennis Bradley. Dennis?
Thank you very much. It's really a new day, and I'm sure many of you have been reporting and watching what's been happening throughout the state of Connecticut, what's been happening throughout the nation, not only in the sadness that's happened with the incidents that have brought us here in this day, but really in the sense of brotherhood that's happened throughout this country and in the state. I've been to rallies where I've seen the majority of the people at the rally are people who are white, who are standing up for rights because they understand that we're all human beings, that every life matter, that black lives matter because every life matter. To have our governor to be the tip of the spear and leadership and to so quickly come up and say, not under my watch will I tolerate this degree of dehumanization, the scourge of racism to exist, and to come up with executive policies and ask our legislator to come back and special sessions to address these issues speaks volumes of where we're going as a nation. And I really commend Governor for making out clear outlines of what we're going to be in the state of Connecticut, to no longer tolerate these chokeholds, to make sure that we empower police officers with cameras, to make sure that we are protecting our citizens, that we no longer look at each other as a problem, but that we police from the sense of service. And those are echoes that have been led here by our governor, and he can be rest assured that from our committee, from my person, and I hope from the rest of the legislature, we lock arms with him and make sure that every citizen in the state of Connecticut feels reassured, feels empowered, understands that they're important, that their lives are important, and I truly, truly, truly appreciate what we're all doing here today. Thank you so much. Thank you, Governor. You deserve a strong round of applause for everything that you're doing for our state. God bless you.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate that. We're going to work on this together, Dennis. And finally, Brandon McGee, head of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, my good friend.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. And thank everyone who's here. I think a lot has already been said with respect to today's announcement. I do applaud the governor, his staff, along with Commissioner Rivella and his team, as well as our co-chairs of public safety on such in a very important day, but a day that I would say we have a lot of work and ground that we need to cover. I think the governor has already said it, so I'm not saying anything new, and that is this is just the foundation that's being laid today for a much larger conversation when we return for special session. But I really just want to underscore a couple things before I step away from the mic. The governor talked a little bit about banning of chokeholds. I think removing any police-related tactic that involves placing an instrument or applying physical pressure where access to breathing is cut off definitely needs to be banned. When you begin talking about the use of force definition, there needs to be some changes around definition, meaning modifying the conditions under which a police officer can legally use deadly force from times when it is reasonable to when it is necessary. This would definitely require de-escalation and improve crisis intervention methods. There are several other areas that I will hold off on. I know that the governor has already mentioned a lot of what I will share with you, but I look forward to working alongside the administration, the chairs of the respected committees, that's judiciary as well as public safety, to come up with some legislation that really considers the community voices that we hear at the rallies and the protest, and not just a policy that we're passing just because we needed to pass something. So I'm delighted to stand with this governor, his administration again, on behalf of the Black and Puerto Rican caucus. The work really starts, y'all, today. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done as we prepare for special session. So again, Governor, thank you. Thank you.
Any questions for Brander?
Now, Governor, can you explain a little bit more about the use of force portal and whether I know right now if an officer draws his taser and uses his taser, there's no report that's required to the state of Connecticut. So what are you asking?
Asking them for there to be a report. I want that listed in real time on this portal. I want to know who, whatever the weapon might have been, who that was used on, whatever the use of force was, the type of person that was used on, so we have some credibility and some transparency in terms of how we're operating.
And this would only apply to the Connecticut State Police?
I'm going to work with the legislature in terms of what we can do with the municipal police as well.
Senator Anwar sent out a letter today asking you to declare racism as a public health emergency. Have you received that letter? Do you have any response to him already?
I think I've said a number of times that there are two highly infectious germs that are infecting the body. One is COVID and the other is racism in this state. I could not have been clearer on that, and we're going to eradicate both as best we can.
For Representatives Bradley and Varengia, is the list of reforms that Governor Lamont has imposed for the state police, is that a good starting point for potential legislation, or would you like to do more, or would you want to do less?
Just before we answer that, if it's okay, I know on behalf of our caucus, we've been working with Health Equity Solutions under the leadership of Dr. Takesha Everett, among other stakeholders, literally declaring health as a new standard when you begin talking about racism. I would add, when we begin talking about the police review boards, making sure independent police review boards, ensuring that community and other stakeholders have an opportunity to be a part of the overall process of managing and also holding our police departments accountable. So that they have a direct insight on, the inner workings of this system that we just don't trust, right? So it's cute that we have recruitment efforts. I think it's awesome. You have PAL, Police Academy Leagues. You have police officers literally walking the beat. My cousin is a police officer. I'm not going to tell you which city, but he's a police officer. Oh, and by the way, happens to be married to a white woman. So just imagine the struggles that he has to encounter. But we love her and we love his family. But I know that there, again, are some good actors and some bad actors. But if we begin to support those who are doing the job well, in addition to some policy changes, you'll have some more trust. But if we don't contend with the historical context as to where we are and how to move forward, then you're always going to perpetuate a lack of trust by Black and brown people. But I think we're at a place where we have an opportunity to change that.